And that went like a dream, I have to say. Hello, everybody in the chat. It seems like I finally got over my boomer problems. Can everybody in the chat hear us okay? Good afternoon. I'm here with Endeavor. Once again, we're going to look at what amounts to Warhammer 40K for rabbits. How are you doing, Endeavor?
I'm not too bad. How are you doing, Morgoth?
I'm doing well. I mean, I have to say for the chat as well, if you're one of those ones where you say, oh, you're reading too much in it, it's just a kid's cartoon, like this really isn't going to be the stream for you, because there's a lot of interesting things in this Watership Down. You hadn't seen it before, had you?
No, this is the first time I saw it. I saw it twice the last week or so. And I have a lot to say about it, but it was a complete unknown for me until then.
It's kind of like an English staple, and I kind of grew up with it. It would appear on the TV from time and time again, and then more recently, it's like it's become this thing that all of the like generation snowflakes scream out about, because they say that it's too violent, it's too traumatic. I mean, there may be some people who aren't that familiar with it in the chat or whatever. So the story, like, it's not that complicated. It's a bunch of rabbits have their home destroyed. One of them, called Fiver, has visions, and then they go off on a journey to find another warren somewhere. But it's made very clear throughout the film that those rabbits are at the bottom of the food chain. And that's like a running motif. And then along the way, led by Hazel, I mean, just as an aside as well, the character actors is brilliant. You've got a lot of, like, John Hurt is Hazel. I think it's Richard Briers as Fiver. There's a lot of old war movies are voicing the rabbits, and there's a couple of women in there as well. So you do have brilliant voice acting behind the cartoon, behind the animation. And they kind of, you know, when they come across the different burrows, they're all organized slightly different, and they've all got like a slightly different philosophy about them. But I think another thing that I thought was interesting on another watch of it was there was a sort of pagan element to the beginning of it, where it's made it because there's a religious and mythological element to all of this. And by the way, this all started Richard Adams, who wrote the book, which I haven't read, but this all started by him driving along and telling his two daughters who would be sitting in the back. And this was him kind of keeping them occupied on long drives. And he ended up writing the book, and it became this, the cartoon of 1978, which we're going to get into here. But then also, which I'll touch on a bit later, maybe the Netflix remake in 2018, which I wasn't that impressed with. So yeah, it's like a journey, and people will say it's a sort of Zionism for rabbits, is one particular take on it. But there's a Wikipedia article, and it's saying that it's for all like nomadic oppressed groups. They mention the Rwandans, and it is like it, so the element, the motif is, can your people and your tribe survive in a very harsh world?
Yeah, so my take on it was that, first of all, it is just a delightful kids cartoon. You know, maybe it's pretty hardcore for a kids show, so maybe it might not be the best for the really young children. But you know, for in terms of a kids cartoon, it, you know, it first of all has beautiful animation. The setting is magnificent. The drawings of the English countryside and the hills, and the way that they present like the changes in the mood with like the clouds will change colors. It is really beautiful, and I like that you pointed out the voice acting. I did think that the guy that was voicing Hazel, he did seem like the quintessential heroic Englishman. I really thought that the voice acting was pretty good too, and it's also well known for the music, like the song. What was it called again? Bright Eyes. The song Bright Eyes. It's a really, really, really powerful scene. Really powerful emotional scene that song comes in on. But then I also thought that it had a lot of really healthy values and a lot of really interesting ones to get into. I guess one thing you pointed out was that it could be seen as Zionism, but I also thought it could be seen as an allegory for people like the Afrikaners or the Quebecois, the Puritans. It does seem to follow that meta narrative of, you know, the people leaving one area to found a new society elsewhere. And yeah, there's definitely a lot to get into in terms of the religion of the rabbits, the nature that they live in, the way that myth informs them, the different structures of the burrow. So there is a lot there.
Yes, I mean, it opens. When it opens, you'll notice that the style of the animation is completely different. Funny enough, I posted the link to the video on Gab, and I saw that Survive the Jive had liked it. And I thought, yeah, I think I can see why he would like this, because he's obviously pagan and he's very interested in this kind of thing. And when you get the opening religious, it's a different kind of animation, and it's made clear by the Frith is the god, and then the Prince of the Rabbits. There's some hard names to pronounce in here. He's called like El Ahara or something, and it's the way they it's explained to them is that the world and all of the creatures in it used to be sort of just dumb and kind of grazing around, but then the rabbits multiplied. The rabbits wouldn't sort of stop breeding, and they were in danger when nobody else would have anything to eat. And Frith told El Halara to sort of wind it in a bit, and he refused. He was a little bit arrogant, and so Frith then gave the other animals the ability to hunt rabbits to control their numbers. And so you see that the rise of the stoat and the fox and the cat and the hawk. So all of these enemies of the rabbit are brought in. And then the rabbits there are then gifted the tail to sort of dazzle people. They're the ability to run really quickly. And he has this really nice kind of poetic line where he's saying like they will hunt you, and when they catch you they will kill you, but you have the ability to run, you have the ability to hide, you've got the ears to listen with. And so this I think there's like a strong paganist element to it, because they're really saying there's a reason for all of this happening. There's the carnage that's about to take place. It's almost like an explanation of the natural world and why it is the way it is. Like, this is the natural order of things. And even to the degree, I mean, I saw one forum and they were making this point where it's almost like a might makes right. But you could, with what the rabbits have done here, there's a mythology created so they know and understand their place in the world, and it isn't just like horror and gore for no real reason. They understand why things are the way they are.
Yeah, one theme that's really interesting in the movie is myth. And I also noted that the animation in the opening of the film, when it's explaining the mythology of the rabbits, their creation myth, the animation was different. That does a lot of work to kind of separate their mythology from the real world. So it kind of gives it this otherworldliness, and it's kind of something that's like divine and separated from the physical world. I thought that was really well done. Now, I also know that the myths, it kind of gives them a understanding of a meta narrative for, you know, why their place in the world, why it is that they're hunted. And, you know, one thing that today we, with rationalism, science and stuff, we often don't really understand the real purpose that myth had served for a lot of traditional peoples for thousands of years. But, you know, myth, in the case of Watership Down, it was the knowledge that had been passed down throughout the generations to adapt the rabbits for surviving. So they're saying, well, yeah, all these other animals are going to try to kill you, but you're fast, you're cunning, and with that you can survive. And I thought it was really fascinating I'd like to get into Darwinism also a bit later, but the world that they are creating is one that is brutal. Like, it's not a happy land that they're living in. Like, there is a lot of scenes where a rabbit gets trapped in a snare. an eagle just flies by, picks him up, and that's it for him. But it was really fascinating how they had created this mythology for to kind of explain, both their place in the world and how they can survive. It's like the traditional knowledge passed down through myth that allows people to survive, because for most of human history, that's how it was done. We didn't have the science to explain to us why certain animals are at the top of the food chain, why some are at the bottom. You kind of relied on these stories.
Yeah, and you even have Fiverr, who's almost like a shaman of the group, where he's really weak and he's kind of panic stricken and hysterical, but he keeps getting these quite horrible visions of blood coming over the fields, and he is the one. I mean, the actual landscape looks like Sussex. I could be wrong, but I think it's the Downs in Sussex. And Watership Down is like that end goal. And it's Fiverr who's direct them along the way. And then, just to sort of, as a little bit of a tangent, you've got Hazel, who's the leader. And then you've got Bigwig, who's like the tough guy of the group. And then they've all left the original Warren, which it's like this brutal massacre. It gets turned over by a human construction company. And then you've got some other like sort of more minor rabbits. Well, they're all voiced brilliantly. And then you've got like the does, but there's a couple of does they are first, but I think they get killed off and they don't speak. They've got to go and rescue more does later from the farm because it's like too much of a sausage fest. I mean, they even trick the seagull into going off, and like Bigwig tries to mount the seagull, and the seagull points out that this is no good. Like, there's no use trying to mount me. You're going to have to go off and get yourself some mates, some actual rabbits. And I mean, I don't want to get too like hung up on I watched the 2018 remake as well. And I know that feminists were outraged by how the does are portrayed in this. And in the 2018 remake one, they've still got to go and get the does for to have mates, but they've introduced like another element to it. And it's where they realize that the male rabbits are unable to dig a warren properly. So it's pointed out that the female rabbits are better diggers than what the male rabbits are, and that's why they've got to go off and rescue. So the idea that the only reason they need the female rabbits is to breed is really downplayed in the recent one, and they say, like, oh well, the females are the ones that are actually going to be digging the warrens. So there's another thing which I'll get into later, which is like, just to contrast the way they slip this political correctness stuff in the 2018 one, there's a much worse version of that as well. But I mean, so when they head off as well, let's get into the sort of the first warren they come across. So they're wandering through and they're on this mythological journey, and they come across in altogether there's four different warrens, and each one of them are different. So the original one is kind of, it's a bit calcified. It's also, all of the warrens are very hierarchical. They have like a chief, which is male. And in the first one, the one that they leave, he's the chief is old and it's kind of conservative, and they don't want to move. He doesn't want to listen. And it's kind of a bit authoritarian. But in the end, they all go under. And the second one they come across is an interesting one to get into, isn't it?
Yeah. So I guess that one thing I should note is that the movie probably is one of the most anti-feminist movies I think I've ever seen. The rabbit society is patriarchal. The political, military, philosophical, religious leaders are all male. And the last act of the movie, if we want to like strip it down to what really it's about, them, killing another tribe and taking their women so they could reproduce. I mean, it's not very politically correct at all. But so one thing I always find very interesting, and it's kind of extending from that, is that kids' movies always seem to have the most based hierarchy structures, because when you think of a lot of kids' movies, it's all, they always have a monarchy. All the Disney princesses, they're princesses. So there's obviously the daughter of a king of some kind. And they all, and you know, it always just seems to be more in line with the natural order. And I think because, you know, kids, they have a lot more simplistic ways of looking at the world. So I think there are some truths that are put into kids' movies that, that, you know, otherwise in a movie for adults, they would think of, and they, you know, insert some political correctness over it. But in terms of the other, the second Warren that they come across. So what's interesting with them is that they come across a Warren, which the rabbits are all like nihilists. So it's important to note that the original Warren, so the Warren of people like of Hazel, Bigwig, Pfeiffer, they're deeply religious. Like the rabbits have religion is a very important part of their society, and it acts as the glue that holds the that holds their Warren together. Whereas the second one they come across, these are guys who have lost their faith, and they actually just welcome the other the men from this other tribe into their burrow. And just to have at their resources. It's also interesting to note that the food that this the nihilistic Warren has, the food is given to them by a farmer. I think they're living on a farm and they're surviving off of his crop yield. So they're also weak because they're not working for their resources. They're not working for it. They've just, it's almost kind of like modernity, really. It's that they just have all this they just have all their physiological needs provided for them. And then the other thing that's interesting is that that Warren also has no females. So what you probably should assume with them is that either their females died because the men were weak. They left them for a tribe of stronger men, or another tribe invaded and took them over. But yeah, this other one is a dying civilization that they come across. But what's the most interesting is that the way that they make them nihilists, the way that they've lost the spirituality, which the original Warren has, which drives them for their, which, you know, pushes people like Hazel towards his civilizational ambition, this nihilistic Warren who has lost their will to live, they've lost that.
Yeah. Like basically this, the second Warren they come across is completely surrounded by snares. And so the humans are giving them food. The humans are giving them, they've allowed them this life of comfort, but then they've also like just laid snares absolutely everywhere. And what's happened with the rabbits is that they've decided that they'll kind of accept that death can just come for them at any moment in return for this material comfort, which says a lot. I mean, of all of the Warrens, like the second Warren is the most like nihilistic. It's the one that's most closely to the West today, where I was going to say sheepish, but it's even worse because of rabbits. They've just kind of accepted their lot. And then when the Five and Hazel arrive, they try to say, well, you know, this isn't natural. And Five instinctively knows that there's something horrible about this. There's something sort of, yeah, somebody in the chat says like it's fatalism, where you've given up all struggle. And Cowslip, who's like the chief of it, he comes out with this poetic kind of patter about how he doesn't like all of this stuff about Frith and El Hara and the Lord of the Rabbit. This is all like mumbo jumbo. So they've gone full kind of rational liberal, and instead it's like we've got what we need and we just have to accept that our day can come. And the reason they want more rabbits in is because of the simple fact that there'll be less chance of them being the ones who die. And so he comes up with this kind of mumbo jumbo about floating, just letting yourself drift down the stream into oblivion and like accepting it. And it is horrible. I think it's the worst of all of the Warrens that they come from. It's like this nihilistic West. It really is like the modern world.
Yeah, and one thing I thought when I saw the movie, I thought that they were going to be planning some kind of ambush. I thought that, you know, there would be something sinister about this tribe of rabbits. But what I thought was interesting was that they really weren't. They were, the thing that was bad about them was they had just kind of given up. And yeah, it is the worst of all the Warrens. That we can get into the totalitarian police state Warren later, but the difference is, though, that at least that one, of course, it's not a system that is ideal, but at least that one will survive because they actually have, first of all, they actually have a will to live. And secondly, they actually have a female population they can reproduce with. I'm pretty sure that the nihilistic one, they didn't have any female rabbits with them. So they were basically just feeding off of the material comfort of the yield of the farmer until, you know, they eventually they just die. And then that's kind of, and then that's just the end of their civilization. So, yeah, I mean, it says a lot about how bad kind of the nihilism, the materialism, and the lack of faith really is for, it really is for a society. It is a pretty accurate way, an accurate way to describe a lot of the West today, that people, you know, they just have a bunch of Netflix and McDonald's cheeseburgers. And, you know, they're just kind of going through life, waiting for the next weekend when they can binge watch the new Netflix series. And they don't really have that any kind of religion to give their life purpose. They don't have any kind of ambition, and they're kind of just waiting for the end. And yeah, that's what that Warren kind of made me think of.
I mean, I was just browsing my notes there, and I did like say I'd had in my notes that the Richard Adams actually disavowed that there was any kind of political message in Watership Down, and they all do that as well. All of these kind of authors, they put this stuff out there, and then they say, well, you know, don't read too much into it. It doesn't have any political. It's just a children's story. And you think, like, okay, hang on a minute. I mean, I really? So, I mean, let's move on to the next Warren is General Woundwards. It's called, what's the big totalitarian one? Is called, I forgot, the name slips us now, but I had it in my mind. And basically, it's in the, I have to say, I will give the 2018 remake, it's juice. Yeah, it's called Efrafar. And the 2018 remake, like, it did, to give it its dues, they did have Efrafar, and it was in this like dilapidated industrial estate. So there was big like bits of walls and stuff sticking out of it. And it was so in this one, at any rate, it's, this one's vast. This Warren is massive, and it's a complete sort of police state with General Woundwood, who's this gigantic one-eyed like beast of a rabbit running it all. And then under him, he's got like all like about 20 different captains. And then there's like a secret police force. And then the does are there just for breeding. And except for one called Hyans Flay. And she's kind of, she kind of talks to the general a little bit, but she's also not to be trusted. And she's a little bit, she's quite subversive, but General Woundwood knows it. And so this is probably the most interesting of all of the Warrens, because in the 2018 remake, I'm going to just say it, there's a scene, and they've got this old train line running into the Warren complex. And then at the end of the train line, they've got this huge like chimney sticking out. And I thought, all right, so, you know, I can see what they're trying to do here. They don't have that in the 1978 one. I very much doubt they've got that in the book as well. But when like Western eyes, when people like us, when we are now trained through media, which is why it's so important to discuss this, we've been psychologically prepared so that when we see a train line, when we're on the train line and we're looking straight down at a large chimney coming out of the ground, like it's deliberate, it's deliberate what they're doing. They know what that means in our minds, and that's how they have represented Efrafar in the 2018 one. In the 1978 one, it isn't the case at all. It's just a big Warren on a kind of half of a hill. But so it's up for grabs whether it's communist or fascist, and the 2018 one, like, not so much. But still, like, I'd like to actually, would you mount a defense of General Woundwood? Like, in defense of General Woundwood, when you look at the world that the rabbits are living in, like, is there an argument to be made for General Woundwood's approach here?
Well, I think that the alternative, if General Woundwood was the alternative to the nihilistic burrow, the one I mean, I'd say that they'd be the best analogy for modern liberalism, which is, you know, do whatever you want, just consume product. If it was between those two, then I'd say that, yeah, the argument for General Woundworth is that his actually will survive. It's brutal. It's tyrannical. It's controlling. But ultimately, that one will live. Now, one thing I read on Wikipedia about the Wikipedia page for the original Watership Down, and I can't believe that they actually wrote this. They said that in the section they have on the themes, it says, it mirrors the, I'm reading the quotation here, mirroring the timeless struggle between tyranny and freedom, reason and blind emotion, and individualism and the corporate state. Now, I probably could not disagree with that description of the, of at least of the 1978 film. I couldn't disagree with that more, because the protagonists, their tribe of their war and their people, they're not liberal, they're not individualists, they don't follow reason. I mean, they're very religious. Their society is very hierarchical as well. They follow myth. Like they leave the original war and not on some kind of like scientific discovery. They leave it on a prophecy. So, you know, the original Warren is very anti-liberal in its own respect. I'd say that the way that I'd contrast the two, and because this past week I just finished reading Aristotle's Politics for the second time. I had read it a few years ago. And by the way, if you haven't read that book, it's just as valuable today as when it was written. One thing that Aristotle points out is that, you know, today we're all really, really used to thinking of bad systems. So like communism we think is bad, or, you know, fascism is bad and liberalism is good. But one thing that Aristotle stresses is the importance of virtue. He says that monarchy is probably the best system if the monarch is virtuous, but it's a tyranny, and that's the worst system if the monarch is not virtuous. I think that the distinguishing factor between someone like Hazel and his and the new Watership Down Warren that he founds and the tyrannical police state one is that he's a virtuous man who's leading it. He is one who is who has a religion. He has a spirituality. He's driven to create a new society. He has civilizational ambitions, and he sacrifices for the long-term health of the collective. Whereas someone like General Woundworth is ruling for his own, he's ruling for his own benefit, really. And I think that that's something that's left out of a lot of, that's the one thing that I think is just left out a lot today, is like, we can only think in terms of systems, and we can't really think in terms of virtue. So I'd say that that's really the distinguishing factor between, the two Warrens, is that one of them is a virtuous one. One of them is a legitimate one, while the other one is a tyranny. I think that more has to do with the people, the virtue of the chief, the man in charge.
Yeah, General Woundworth is like, he's sort of like he signed up to the great rabbit of history theory, where there's supposed to be this certain way in a certain system, and he's changed the entire course of history. And there's actually like a sort of, this is how into these things I get when I'm going to do a stream. There's actually like a deep lore on Watership Down and General Woundworth. And it turns out that he began life as a hutch rabbit, and he was tortured by a cat, and that's how he lost his eye. And then he escaped from the hutch, and when he was like basically alone in the wilds, and they even do like a kill count, where he apparently got a General Woundworth got attacked by two stoats and killed them both. He took on six rats. He fought a fox to a standstill, and then he found a warren and went into the warren and killed the leader and took it over. And then he began taking over all of like six or seven warrens in the whole area. So and sort of encompassed them all into his super warren with him at the top. So it's like General Woundworth's got this will to power. And what's he's a kind of the over rabbit in a Nietzschean way. And what's funny as well is that at the start, so the rabbits are supposed to be at the bottom of the food chain. And Woundworth points out that actually there's nothing can threaten them. Like he's got, um, he, he's, he's created such a powerful and massive rabbit warren with him at the top that nothing can hunt them anymore. Or, you know, the odd one would get picked out. And so, if, like, just through sheer willpower and ferocity, he's flipped it on its head. So the rabbits have now got this super colony, and they're kind of like dominating the whole countryside through it. And this is like, you know, I know people in the chat are going to be like, yeah, this is the guy we need. But it is a pretty grim reality when you see that they get slashed and they get the mark put on them. There's secret police and everything like that.
Yeah, although, I mean, that's not, like, entirely out of the ordinary for the other warren, too, because at the beginning, it's important to note that the original warren that they're at, it wasn't liberal either. It was a absolute monarchy. The original rabbit, I forget what the guy's name was, the rabbit that was there at the beginning, who was this old guy, but he is, like, a dictator, essentially. What he says goes. When Hazel comes to him with Pfeiffer's vision about what's going to happen to their burrows, how they're going to be filled in, he just ignores them, and then that's just that. There isn't really this like liberal decision made. It is made from the hierarchy. It's also interesting to note that when they try to escape the officer, yeah, they have like a police force, they have officers, and this like entire military hierarchy. He basically threatens them with arrest for spreading dissent, and then I think that they had said that like, the reason they leave is they are basically forced to leave and not come back is because Bigwig actually wounds this officer, and they even point out that what he had done was a capital offense, and that if they were to return, they'd be given the death penalty. So, you know, the original warren, they are in line. They do have a realistic understanding of nature. But I never really got the sense like it was an unjust one, though. So I don't think I never thought that kind of system of hierarchy was one that was unjust. Whereas with General Woundworth's warren, it is pretty clear that it is. So I do think that it is possible to have one which takes on the reality of nature. I was about to say human nature, the reality of rabbit nature. And the nature of the nature as prey for other predators, and still have one that is in line with some kind of natural order that actually is still it's actually still a good place to live. I don't think that necessarily that's impossible, but it's certainly not under a liberal system, though.
Yeah, I mean the closest of the different warrens that's in it, the closest one to a liberal system is the second one. It is that fatalistic sort of black-pilled that is where they've rejected the religion and everything. I mean, even General Woundworth and his captains are still religious. They're not as dominated by it as Fiver and Hazel and the gang. But he will say things like, he says something like for Frith's sake. Like, so even they are still more or less within that mythological religious thing. It's only the second one which has completely like rejected it entirely. And the one like sort of the Watership Down itself, even like, none of them are liberal. The world that they're in isn't liberal because they just couldn't survive. So in one way or another, they have to stick together just for the sake of living. And even like Watership Down, which is kind of like the paradise one, even that, you know, they dance around it a little bit, but even that has a leader. Even Hazel is the chief, and Bigwig is going to be the head of like the Ausla, which is the sort of the police force. So, and then they're going to have this religious, that would be the most religious of all the warrens, would be the one that at the end were Watership Down.
Yeah, so one thing that I think is a very interesting theme that kind of ties into the religion is something that maybe might be a bit surprising, but the movie is extremely Darwinian. So, Darwinism, the belief in survival of the fittest, that humans, or all species for that matter, are adapted to survive, the strongest survive and the weakest die out. When we talk about that, about Darwinism with human society, historically it's been something that which has driven people away from religion because it posits that, you know, people are really just you know, we're descended from monkeys or something like that. And we kind of just, the genes have been selected for to make us more adapted to survive. And, you know, on the surface, it doesn't really seem like a, it doesn't really seem like a description of the world that really lends itself to religion. It doesn't really seem to be one that lends itself to spirituality. And, you know, historically it's been what's driven a lot of people away from faith. Now I want to also note though that Darwinism is not left wing at all. It's probably the most right wing ideal. It's the most right wing way of looking at the world possible. So any leftist who tries to claim that, you know, to own the Christians or something like that, they're being dishonest. But what I find interesting, and I think this was probably my favorite part of my favorite theme in the film Watership Down, and I always found this very poetic about the world, is that, I take a lot of these ideas on board that, yeah, man in nature is a savage creature. You know, human nature is not, it's no care bear. But it does seem like humanity is, it does seem like we are adapted to think religiously. So all human societies have developed some kind of religion. All human societies have developed the arts. So it does seem like we're evolved to recognize things like beauty. We are evolved to think about a higher power. We're evolved to think about ourselves as towards a greater purpose, as something bigger than us. And that, you know, that's something I've always found very, I've found very poetic, is that kind of, when you look at the Darwinian struggle, it does seem like one that's nihilistic, but like you can look at the work of Edward Dutton, it does seem that the religious survive. The ones who actually have a sense of truth, goodness, and beauty, they're the ones that survive that cruel nature. And that's kind of what Watership Down suggests, though, because the world that they're in, it is cruel. Like, they're hunted, but there's a scene where Violet, I think she was like the only doe that had, the only female that had left the warren with them. And shortly after she leaves, there's just a bird that swoops by, picks her up, and then Pfeiffer just says, "Violet's gone now." And, you know, that's kind of just it. But that cruel world does lend itself to religion. And that does suggest that there is more to life than simply just the material, simply just surviving. The spiritual is important.
Yeah, and that's what I mean. That I was thinking about the more pagan side of that as well, because you're in this great drama of nature. You're in the natural world, and even when things may seem brutal and harsh, then there's at least a reason behind it all. So when you create this great sort of chain of being, and then man himself as well with the paganism, he would be in it. And part of it. And so when you're like the forum I was reading, they were talking about how the house cat was knocked down on a road, and this pagan woman picked it up and took it back in and showed her children this cat with its guts hanging out. And it was like, you've got to understand, like, this is the natural way of things. So it's about confronting death as it really is, and that, in this case, the rabbits understand that they have their place in this. And the thing is, it's like, what would it be like? Because when you're in the natural world, then you are, and, you know, go back thousands of years, the Europeans would be the same. They're going to have this, because if you don't have anything like that, you have to give it meaning in the way that the rabbits do here. Because if you take Violet, where she just pops out from the field and has a little nibble, and she's just randomly, like, just plucked up, just taken away by a hawk. Just that's it. She's gone. What you're going to end up with is the second burrow, is the second warren, where nothing has any real meaning, nothing has any purpose, and all of a sudden life just becomes this horror show. Where this is like something like what Nietzsche was trying to grapple with. Well, what do you do? How do you get over that? How do you get through this staring into the abyss? And it seems as you can cling on to the religion, like Hazel and Fiverr do, or there is, like, you know, I made a joke about it, but all that is like the general wound wort, just will to power and mastery. And then for humans as well. I mean, it's interesting because what I was thinking about this when I was walking my dog earlier, and my dog's killed loads of rabbits, funny enough. And it isn't, you know, I think it's a liberal, it's like the people in the modern world, I think they've got this coping mechanism when it comes to violence in the natural world, where they like to tell themselves that the death is always swift, and they're only doing it because they need to eat. And this kind of thing. Well, yeah, that's true. But like, I've had to kill many a rabbit myself because my dog's like done one in, and it's like screeling, rolling around as my dog plays with it. It can be quite sadistic. So, and then you look at some of the other things that happens in nature. You know, think of these caterpillars where wasps lay their eggs in it. And then the larvae comes out and like feeds inside of the caterpillar. It's nature isn't as it isn't as straightforward as that. And the funny thing is, it's fundamentally like brutal and harsh, which leads to you having to have some sort of mythological structure. And I think that's why so many in modernity who are, on the one hand, they've like rejected the see religious connotations of everything, they're just atheists, but at the same time they can't bring themselves to kind of admit and look the true nature of life straight in the face.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of a coping mechanism for a lot of people today. Like, you know, I'm pretty sure anyone in our sphere of politics has had that one person who just like winces anytime you say anything remotely right wing. So, you know, when you start to bring up even very basic things, like, you know, saying that this, you know, this, like the immigration policy is not creating a very healthy society, a lot of them do kind of just wince because they can't understand that man and nature is not is actually quite brutal. I don't know who it was that had this quotation, but I've stolen this many times. What they said on, I think it was on Twitter, they said that liberalism essentially, it would work if human nature was that of a Care Bear, but it isn't really. And the problem we have today is that a lot of people can't really even conceptualize that, because they've just spent their entire lives living in an unnatural state of just pure comfort, pure safety, and never really having to face the elements that people in prior generations would have had to have faced. They can't really bring themselves to understand that, you know, that is what human nature is like. The suburb and the family with the golden retriever, that is not the human norm. The human norm for almost all of history is something similar to how the early how the pagans would have lived, you know, 2,000 years ago on these snowy fields where they have to go off and hunt a caribou to survive or something like that. But you know, I think that one thing that the film does actually very well is that it does expose kind of that side of nature, because, you know, for a kid's movie, it does have a lot of blood. Like, there's that one scene where Bigwig gets trapped in a snare, and it is a pretty hard scene to watch. That'd be one that I imagine a lot of the kids might have cried when they saw, because he gets choked, and you see increasingly how he's losing more and more blood. But you know, that's really the nature, though. Eventually, because what nature is that the rabbits will eventually die, and then that's just it, really.
I mean, people in the chat are mentioning that Captain Holly, who he was the one who originally tried to stop them from leaving the first warren, and then of course that warren gets complete. I mean, you talk about horror. The most horrific scene is when you get this montage scene when the first warren goes over, and you see like hundreds of little rabbit heads, and they're all trapped underground trying to get out, and they can't do it, and they're screaming in the dead earth as they get just crushed under the weight of the construction which is going on above them, because they didn't get out in time, and it's all being filled in. It's really brutal. And Holly gets away from that, and then he falls into the clutches of the Effrophins, the general wound ward, and eventually he finds his friends, and he's completely wrecked and battered. They've ripped his ear to bits, and he's got the mark, the three strikes of the Ephrathan sort of mark. And it's one of sacrifice, but by and large, that's also a running theme in the whole thing, is that what matters is that the group survive. So one rat or the other rabbit may die, but the group will go on. It's pure collectivism. There's all kinds of funny, like, kind of trad themes in there. And Holly and the others sacrifice. I mean, so does Hazel. Sacrifices himself for everything, for the greater good. One thing that I wanted to put on, get into as well, was that the as on a side note, is the cat. So in this, like, animals, they're quite selective about which animals have consciousness and can speak. And then, but like, so the dogs, you'll notice that a dog and a fox can't. The dog is really just like a big dumb animal. It's just like this mindless killing machine. But at the same time, the cat, it can speak, and it is like crafty, and it's one of the very few female voices in there. So it jumps on them and it remembers the, like, so it's really strange how they have done that, I think.
Yeah, I also found it interesting, the scene at the farm where initially there, because their initial plot to actually make Watership Down a functional burrow was to steal the females from the farm where the cat was, and that's why they have to get around the cat, because the cat's protecting the barn from Hazel and his men, who are trying to get in there and free the female rabbits that they have in a cage. So their initial plot is to get in there and to open the cages and then release the female rabbits, but that one eventually just fails. That plot never just never materializes, because they're just not able to do it.
And then the doors themselves are all kind of just blank slates. One of them can speak because she has to, and then the rest of them are just they're just like sort of background. They've got as much agency as the dogs do. Except it's very funny. I mean, I can understand why the feminists scream blue murder. And in the 2018 one, they've certainly rectified that to the degree where, oh well, we need the female rabbits now because we can't dig warrens anymore. And then also what they changed was the Frith was now a female voice as well, whereas in the original it's a classic old English actor called Michael Horden. So you know they did kind of change all of that stuff around. But just to get back to the mythology and the religious stuff, I think it is important. You can see if your group has a vision of itself, it's not just about say collectivism, the way we usually use it, but if your particular group has an overarching sort of religious vision of where they're going, which is like it's emerging as you go on, then it's like no matter, I think this is the main lesson of Watership Down as well, is that you can't, it's very, very difficult to beat you, because what you're really getting at, like, so Hazel would think it that, or Fiver would think that it was just destiny that they ended up at the promised land of Watership Down. And, you know, there's groups in the real world who've operated something like that as well, where it's like you don't just have this master plan. It's more than that. It's something which is, it is destiny. It will come into being. What then happens is that no matter what stands in your way, no matter how many people die, no matter what carnage is created, no matter what struggles you have to go through, it will happen in the end. And it's as something to bind a group together, it's something extremely powerful, I think.
Oh yes, there's like no individualism, like you mentioned earlier. One thing that I thought was interesting about the character of Hazel, and then the rest of them as well, they probably won't live to actually see that burrow fully materialize, the Watership Down burrow. That's something that they're building for future generations. Something that within their lifetime they never will actually see. At the very end of the film, Hazel passes away an old man, and you know the burrow is getting started, and he goes to run with the black rabbit. It's like some spiritual idea that they have that once the chief dies, can't remember exactly what it was, but he will reach some kind of transcendent. But you know, when I thought of Hazel, I thought of a lot of figures from history. Someone like Jan van Riebeck. If you don't know who that is, he's the first Dutch. He was the first Dutch governor of the Cape Colony in South Africa. He's considered the founding father of the Afrikaners. Or someone like John Smith, I think he was the governor of. He was one of the first Englishmen in Virginia. Or someone like Samuel de Champlain, who was the first Frenchman to establish a colony that lasted, a lasting settlement in Quebec. And he's considered the founding father of the Quebecois people. But you know, when I think of these historical figures, none of them really were none of them really would have been part of the group that they founded, because that came after. Jan van Riebeck was a Dutchman. What's his name? Samuel de Champlain was a Frenchman. He wasn't a Quebecois. The Quebecois weren't a thing yet. John Smith was an Englishman. He wasn't an American. But it is that kind of pioneering spirit. There has to be someone to take that first step. And that's kind of where, and that's where civilization comes from. But it is something that's very anti-individualist, because all those first pioneers, they never actually get to see their vision materialize. That drive that they have, that, you know, it's destiny that we, whether or not some of these colonists had that kind of idea or not. I know a lot of the Puritans did, who went to North America. That drive is something that you have to think beyond your own lifetime, because what's going to come about is going to be something that is intergenerational. But it is something that that kind of vision, though, is what leads men to do great things. And I think that, you know, Hazel was like, I thought the character of Hazel, he really was kind of that archetype. He was that kind of first pioneer archetype, someone like Jan van Riebeck or Samuel de Champlain.
I think it also, with, you know, one particular group in mind, it also lends itself to ruthlessness in a harsh world. So, you know, if you have your tribe, and you have a particular vision of how the world should be, and everybody is conscious of it, then there is plans within plans. But at the same time, even individually, you can all work toward that end. Even when you're off doing your own thing, you're still going to be part of, as you said at the start, that meta narrative. But when you've got this sort of chaotic atomized individual thing, which everybody talks about now, then there is no collective vision. Then there can't be one either. You can't possibly bring anything into being, because you don't agree on even the basic premise of what it should be. And in the case of European people, something like that would be considered completely out of the equation, completely out of the question before you even got going, which, and funny enough, it's only us that's in that situation as well.
Yeah, because, you know, if, let's just take my analogy of like the early pioneers again, if they were just complete individuals, what would be the point of somebody leaving, say, like, I don't know, 17th century London or something like that, to go live in this barren, you know, wasteland in North America, where it's cold the entire year, unless you have a vision for building something into the future. There's no incentive to take that first step, and you never can create something like that, because you don't have any kind of vision of yourself in a grander meta narrative that is intergenerational. If you're just an individual, you'll never actually contribute towards anything greater than yourself.
You can take a look at something like Durham Cathedral or Canterbury Cathedral. Like, it wasn't where somebody just laid the groundwork and did the designs and then a bunch of fellas like built it. It took hundreds and hundreds of years. It took generations and generations to build Durham Cathedral. And it's when you, like, the men who started laying the foundations of Durham Cathedral, they knew they would never get to see the spires on that. They knew they'd be dead before the Spires. That's will. That's grit. That's vision. That then we've got none of that. That's what we really need in Europe, in the West. And there's none of it. None of it. Nobody would be interested in laying the foundations for something which they'd never see in their lifetime. And that's, you can thank the dominant ideology of the day for that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I remember I heard another story. I can't remember which university this was from, but I had, and I'm hopefully getting it right because I can't remember where it was, but I heard that they had built their library out of like oak wood, and they had cut down a bunch of oak trees and built this beautiful wooden library out of it. And then after several centuries, the wood started to rot, and they found in their archives that, like at the university's founding, in this one field, not too far off, they had planted new oak trees that could be used because by the time this oak wood would start to rot, these new oak trees would be mature and they could be cut down and used to replace the original oak trees. So they had all that. They had that foresight to think of. Not only is this institution we're creating going to be here hundreds of years later when we're long gone, we also want to make sure that they're able to preserve its beauty, preserve its very spirit for something that new generations in the future can enjoy. And yeah, that's like something that's completely gone today.
Yeah, you're just in the here and now, and that's it. You're literally, and so in that regard, you know, you're actually living more like an animal, where you do just live in the here and now. That's what we've been reduced to. The funny thing is as well, like on the question of the trees, is that what you'll see today is that they very rarely plant those kinds of trees. What they prefer is the like fast growing things that we've imported from Canada, the conifers and all of these where you have to see the results within 2 years. There has to be a new woodland there within 2 years, and they'll have each individual tree counted and marked. Whereas if you did have like a long-term vision of the society, your society, and how you wanted it to be, you could actually plant trees which were going to, you know, reach their full glory hundreds of years in the future.
Yeah, and I thought of the idea of what the term I heard for it was ethnogenesis. What ethnogenesis is, it's essentially a group of people becoming a new group of people due to its different historical circumstances. And, you know, I thought of that with the theme of the rabbits. So the rabbits leave their burrow. And I believe they say at the beginning of the movie that their specific breed of rabbit has a white tail, which is supposed to symbolize that he's fast or something like that. I can't remember exactly what it was, but the rabbits were a very distinct breed. So the other burrows they go to, like the nihilistic one, they're all brown rabbits. The General Woundsworth's burrow, they all have green eyes. So they're all like very unique. And is the new burrow, is Watership Down the same as the previous one? And I have to say, probably not exactly. First of all, that there is, of course, you know, the genetics are going to be slightly different because they eventually had to kill Woundsworth's warren and steal their females. But even if we put that aside, you can look at like historical examples of the English settlers in North America or the French Quebecois in the French settlers in Quebec. They do kind of become something new. There is some kind of this ethnogenesis that takes place that through historical circumstances, whether it's a change in land, a change in culture or religion of some kind, maybe it's due to an invasion. But what you see is that there is one group that kind of becomes another. And that's an idea that I'm very interested in today because, you know, and I think of the state of the West today. I think of some my country like Canada, or I think it's very applicable to North America. I don't think it's as applicable to Europe because these are a lot older people groups. But, you know, what does it mean to be an American today? What does it mean to be a Canadian today? Not really all that much. And I think that, you know, maybe a better vision for the future is one that's similar to, say, like the early Dutch settlers in South Africa or the English settlers in North America. It is. I think it might actually be a better vision to think along those lines. Think along the lines of ethnogenesis. That, you know, we might not live to see what comes about in the future, but, you know, our work today is something that can actually bring about something that can bring about something for future generations. Based on the historical circumstances that they find themselves in. But in order for that to happen, the work needs to be put in today.
Indeed. And it's all part of that grand vision, which, I mean, just to sort of move it on a little bit, is when at the end, the El Hara, the Black Rabbit, comes to meet Hazel. And what I want to move on to is just how triggered like Generation Snowflake gets by Watership Down. And so at the end, in a standard kids, especially kids cartoon, this was a U as well, which means it's like just opened all, it didn't even get like a 12 or anything on it, or even a PG. It was like, so basically under fives could watch this. And then at the end, so even the like general wound word, you don't know if he dies. That would be some kind of catharsis. You just see him leap towards the dog after he's invaded Watership Down. And there's this scene where he's just bounding through the warren, just killing everything he comes across, like in seconds as well. It's just like he's got this move of like clawing the rabbits in the back and then tearing their throat out and throwing to one side like a rag doll. And he just kills and kills and kills in the warren. And there's one of them called Blackavar, who's sort of a trouble. He's been like a pain in General Woundwat's arse for a long time, like tried to escape time and time again. And he's really been tortured horribly. There's like nothing left of his ears. He's just, emaciated. He's half starved and he's half mad. And then it's like his last act in life is like to defy the general one more time. And the general just instantly rips his throat out and throws him to one side. So you'd expect like the standard writing techniques would be that you would really have to see the general getting some horrible, horrible death in order for people to be like, feel a little bit happy about it. And what actually happens is that he jumps towards the dog, because it's in like the deep lore that General Woundwort will never back down from anything. So it isn't like he's this scheming coward. He literally, like, you know, as I said earlier, they've created this character. He is brave. He isn't like just a coward who's going to run away. He will stand to the very last. And he's even calling his captains, they're all cowards because they're running away from the dog. I mean, like dogs aren't dangerous, he says. And it's like, it's literally, there's this huge, horrible Rottweiler type thing. And then he jumps towards it and the dog jumps towards him. And then it just goes into the sun and you find out that his body's never been recovered. But the parents, if they tell the bunnies, if you don't behave yourself, the general will get you. It's true. Bigwig puts up a good fight, but in my opinion, Bigwig was going to lose eventually to the general. Like, but then, even then, you think, okay, well, at least we're going to see them happy ever after. And that you don't get that either, because then Hazel's, like the Black Rabbit appears and says, well, I know that you've been feeling tired now, Hazel. Like, do you want to join my Ausla? And so Hazel just lies down and dies. And then the two of them kind of drift away as ghosts. And even in Rabbit Heaven, there's going to be a hierarchy with captains and a police force. So it's just, and I just think what I've seen on and off over the years, you'll see Watership Down trending on Twitter, and it's because you've got all of these millennials and probably not so much the Gen Z, but you've got a lot of people of a certain who've come of age after they say the 80s and the early 90s, and they actually can't stand Watership Down. They think, not just because of the sort of the feminist angle, but because they just find it like genuinely traumatic to watch. They feel as if it should be like classed as a horror movie.
And what I thought was really interesting about the way that they leave General Woundworth's fate kind of ambiguous, that it is incorporated into their mythology. So like, what did they say again? That if the young rabbits wander off, then General Woundworth is going to get them. Was that what they had said?
Yeah. If you don't behave yourself, the general will get you.
Yeah. And what's interesting about that is that it's incorporating their people's experience, their historical experience as a people, into their modern knowledge, their modern understanding, their modern wisdom, really, through mythology. So, you know, this is an event that would have happened, you know, generations later, when these mothers are telling their young rabbits that it's an experience in their history that they've kind of learned from, and that they're keeping alive. Like, they're keeping alive the experience of their people having to fight a foe like General Woundworth. They're keeping alive the suffering of their people for generations in the future to remember and to learn from that wisdom. And I thought it was really good. It was really interesting how they put that into myth. I know the you-know-whos do that a lot, really, but it is something that actually is very effective. It is effective to kind of remember your people's historical struggles and to kind of incorporate that into the wisdom that you tell yourself today. And myth is usually, well, historically, myth was the way that people would do that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's part of your story. And it's things, as you mentioned about the you-know-whos, it's then something which is done to them. It isn't, just to take the case of General Woundworth, it would be a case where he was this hugely traumatic, and, you know, I'm sure he's probably still got a few loyalists. I know if I was sitting around in Watership Downward, how soft and easy life had become. I'd have been thinking, wasn't it better when we ruled the whole countryside with General Woundworth? Like, doesn't he get a bit of a raw deal? Can we not have some kind of General Woundworth revisionist history going on where we resurrect him or something? All of this kind of thing. But what instead we get is that when, like, a traumatic thing or an injustice, it isn't done to our group, and if you're European, it's done to an individual, or it's done to a set of individuals. So you just all this sort of deracinated clump of units, whereas everybody else does see it that way. Everybody else does see an injustice to our group, and they tell you about it every day.
Yeah, and it's super effective in terms of actually rallying your people behind a cause. Now, I think a lot of the stuff that they tell people today is bullshit, but even if it isn't true, it is the mythology that's what gets people behind it. You know, one of the biggest problems with postmodernism is that we've rejected meta narrative, so we no longer actually understand ourselves as part of some grand historical narrative. But at the same time, it's also kind of a lie, because we're still supposed to take seriously various other historical meta narratives, while our own is completely like deconstructed through things like rationalism or ironism or things like that. But then what you do see with other groups, like, for example, there's some that, you know, questioning their meta narratives can land you in jail. Or, you know, maybe other ones, maybe not quite so much, but it could get you fired from your job. You know, that's actually extremely effective. But, you know, they've done a lot of work to kind of undermine that in Europeans, and trying to remove their sense of being a part of a longer historical narrative, because it is something that gives a group power.
Yeah. I mean, I just wanted to get into this thing about the violence and why people say it's traumatic. But it interests me, because is there such a thing as right-wing violence and left-wing violence? Because it seems to me, if I think of, like, torture porn and all of these things, and I think that is, like, left-wing violence. But I would think of a war movie or Watership Down, which kind of is a war movie, really, but that is, like, right-wing violence. But why is it that people get upset with some violence and not others, is what I think of, like, a bit of a mystery. Like, because people genuinely dislike Watership Down, and they'll say it's so traumatic. And then I noticed in the 2018 one, like, the violence was massively toned down. Like, really, it really just isn't there. I think one or two rabbits dies, and one of them is on a train track where you don't even see it. Whereas in the one we're talking about, you get these close-ups where the rib cage is hanging out, and yet you'll notice that when the rabbits die, like, their tongues are hanging out and all of this, and there's blood everywhere. And I just think it's strange that there's such a, like, on the one hand, we think of this society as being a complete nut house. Like, things have got so much worse that since 1978. 1978 and in the 80s, this wasn't really considered to be too brutal. Like, it picked up the reputation for trauma. It's traumatized my childhood. It's, you know, it was childhood trauma. That came later. That's the thing that picked up in the 2000s. And over the last 20 years or so, people didn't look at it like that originally. And if you think of another one from the 80s as well, is Neverending Story, where you've got a scene, Neverending Story, where there's this young prince who's on an adventure and his horse gets stuck in a swamp, and it's called like the Swamp of Despair or something. And he's like, the horse has become like blackpilled. And the more blackpilled you get, the more you sink down into the swamp of despair. And this young boy is like screaming at the horse. Can't remember its name now. And eventually the horse does just go under. And you see like its white mane going under the sludge. And then you see the boy just walking by himself through. And again, like people are saying, like in the 80s, there was something very dark in children's fiction and children's movies of the 80s. But the thing is, like now, where it's like a free for all. Now, to me, now is like degenerate. Do you see what I mean? It's much more. Things are much more degenerate and like horrifying now than they were in the 80s. So why is it that violence has become this taboo?
That is interesting, though, because one there's a meme that is on the internet, and it's a couple, maybe a decade or so old, but it was that people were more sad when a dog died in a movie than a human. I think it's just because a lot of the dehumanization that our culture really pushes. Like one thing I read when I was doing the research for my video on The Public Enemy is that it was considered like a shockingly violent movie for when it was released in 1931. But then if you compare that to any like gangster flick that's come out in the last 30, 40 years, I mean, it's just like, it'd be rated G in comparison to these. You know, there's no scene of like, gangsters being like, you know, tortured with a knife, like having slashes put in their face or something like that. There's no like dead corpses. Well, okay, yeah, there is one, but you don't see them like these like very horrible wounds on them. There's no like scene of someone getting beaten by a baseball bat or anything like that. But in the case of Watership Down, maybe it's the fact that it's animals that the violence is being committed with, because when you think of modern movies, like it's very very common to see much more violence, much more wanton violence than would have been commonplace a couple decades ago, or even if you can go further back than that. I think it could be because we have been desensitized to violence committed against humans. But with animals, we haven't gone through that same conditioning, so we still kind of wince when we see a cartoon of a rabbit get caught in a snare, while we are totally okay with, you know, a video game where someone's head gets when someone's head explodes from being shot by a shotgun or something like that.
Yeah. So right, I think I'm gonna hit the super chats. I'll start off an entropy with Sensum Communum. Thank you very much. £5. Would Endeavour and yourself consider doing a classic movie review of Ralph Bakshi's 1978 part animation, part live action version of The Lord of the Rings? I feel that this is a very underrated film. Yeah, I know of that one. I'm not the biggest fan of. Do you know that one, Endeavour?
I've heard of it, but I haven't seen it.
I saw it when I was a kid. As far as I know, it only goes up to like the Two Towers or something. But what is really great about it is the way he does the orcs. It's a sort of, I mean, you should check it out. The Ralph Bakshi, how he does the orcs of Lord of the Rings, is really good. It's really dark. It's sort of, I don't know what the style you would call it, but it's a cartoon, but the orcs are sort of a cinema. They look more like live action actors wearing costumes, but it's very, very dark how he's done that. But I have to say, some of the other Ralph Bakshi stuff is a little bit kind of dodgy. It's like he'll slip in like genitals for no reason at all. If you look at some of the other ones he's done, but yeah, that may be one for the future as well. But as far as I'm aware, I haven't seen a one that goes all the way like right through the Lord of the Rings saga. So I'd have to have a look more closely at that. Irish crows have a pint morgue off for being so obese. Thank you very much. Westo, where else can you hear a seagull scream piss off? Oh, and that's true. The seagull is they changed that as well. So he has this the seagull in the 1978 one has got like this really over the top French accent. That like it's like almost a parody of how an English person would take the piss out of how a French person speaks, kind of thing. But then the film board of political correctness decided that was a bit too much. So the seagull in the new one they did is like he's got this lazy kind of Scottish accent, like he's this laid back jock. And you just think, oh, it's so pathetic. It really is. So anyway, Malark, just £5. White is the new green. You should do Talk of the Otter. Yeah. So thanks for that £10. Talk of the Otter is lovely. I saw that when I was a kid. I'll definitely have that may be on YouTube as well. Talk of the Otter is a beautiful film about... But that ends badly as well, now that you think of it. I don't want to give a spoiler away. It just popped into my mind. But it's set on a little Scottish fishing village in the early 70s or something. And it's I think it's about like a Scotsman takes in an otter. And then you've also got Kes, where a young boy living in Yorkshire, like he's dirt poor, and he takes in a little baby kestrel and brings it up, and that doesn't end very well either. So yeah, Talk of the Otter is gorgeous. I think I will be watching that again, maybe do a review. Nobody's talking about Captain Holly. Yeah, we did when I saw that. And then he also, this is Clownetto for £5, and then he also gives one for £2 and says Holly was the only white furred rabbit too. So yeah, I mean Yeah, that's true. I mean, they do get a little bit grey here and there. I wouldn't read too much into the colour of the rabbits in that regard. Like, so yeah, Kes was a good one. It's more of a social drama about poverty in Yorkshire and all that kind of thing. Talk of the Otter has more of a Wicker Man feel to it. It's got that lovely Scottish scenery like you find in the Wicker Man. So, Ring of Bright Water, that could be the one I was thinking of. Like, I'll have to look into that because it's been a long time. So, I'm kind of like thinking if there's any final points on Watership Down. Have you got any endeavor?
No, I think we did the film justice. It's not a huge film, so I mean, I don't know if we can do a stream longer than. I mean, the stream's almost as long as the film itself, so I think we've done it justice. Yeah, I basically just say in summation. Definitely a really good film. Maybe don't show it to your 3 or 4 year olds, but you know, your kids are starting to get to adolescent age. You could do a lot worse than that. You know, healthy values, delightful film. I guess one thing we could comment on is the aesthetics of the film. The animation is beautiful. The music's very nice. The setting is very whimsical. And it definitely is a good, it does set the mood for a good story, I thought.
Yeah, the music especially. To be fair, it is famous for having good music, and animation. I was watching one YouTube channel, and he kind of compared the new one to the old one, and I was thinking, and he went through different ways you could compare them, you know, and it came to the animation, and I thought, well, the 2018 one's CGI'd, so it doesn't really, you know, the old one doesn't stand a chance. And he pointed out that actually the animation, the cartoon animation, is better. And he was going off just the expressions on the faces of the rabbits. Like, they genuinely do have expressions of happiness and sadness. And the CGI, they've always got this sort of blank look on their faces. Even, like, there's one where Bigwig is standing there and he's expected to kill High and Flay, the captains at Efrafa. Pin Heisenflay down, and Bigwig has to like prove himself by killing Heisenflay, who's a bit of a pain in the arse to the general. And then you'd expect, and I never picked it up, but you'd expect like some kind of emotion And it's that, it's Finn, it's that black lad from Star Wars who's doing the voice as well, which is a bit crap, to be honest. But then the look on his face is just completely blank. There's no expression on it. It's like he's got this big dramatic moment, and it's kind of crap. And what they do as well is make him, the problem that I think happens is that because of like the background of the voice actor, they've made him more of like a kind of hard boy from the get-go. Whereas in the bigwig from the original one is more like a sort of British soldier from World War II. He has that kind of stoicism to him, which, you know, like a British soldier. Whereas what we think now of being like, say, tough isn't like a soldier from the Empire or something. It's like a ghetto kid from the hood or something like that. And that's just, it's just like a little reason why everything's crap. So Mrs. Mean It for £5. Thank you very much. Fantastic chat. All from a rabbit film. So many meanings about humanity. Now going to have to watch it again and cry like a baby at the end. Yeah, I mean, the thing is, when people say, oh, well, this isn't what the author meant by this, I don't think it matters. I think there's these perennial, eternal truths about, especially about our people. Yeah, I suppose it's for all people, but for Europeans, and they kind of manifest themselves even without thinking about it. In the same way that, say, I'm busy reading Warhammer 40K books, and you can see the same themes from history and whatnot like pop up, even though like the kind of the bookmen who consume this stuff or the writers, well, I think the writers are aware of it, but it's kind of like it just happens naturally. If you look at somebody like Hannibal Lecter, I did a video on this before, where Hannibal Lecter is pretty much a vampire. Now, he's a vampire in the modern era, though. He's a vampire that has to operate in the world of psychology and the FBI and these experts in criminology and all of that. But the form is the same. It is just the same thing. It's just that it has to sort of manifest itself through Lecter. But he is just what in the past we would think of as a vampire.
Yeah, I think that with art, good art is an expression of truth. You know, I think that beauty often is an expression of goodness in the physical form. And yeah, with a lot of these films, I mentioned this at the beginning. All these kids movies, they all have this like right wing hierarchical society structure. They're always monarchies or something like that. And I think that one of the reasons that kids films tend to be a lot of times they're very deeply right wing is because you are trying to express certain just truths about the world to somebody who's very young and can't actually, I mean, they can't understand ideology, that's for sure. So you can't really just slip it in there like that. So yeah, you know, I you can say that wasn't the author's intention, but it definitely is expressing certain truths about the world, which are very right wing.
And if you asked, I mean, if you leaving aside the sort of what got on my nerves about how people say that, you know, that traumatized them as children, if you asked like a healthy young boy, like who are your favorite characters in Watership Down, they would say Bigwig or the General. They wouldn't say, you know what I mean? They were, even on the new one, they wouldn't say it was Heisenflay or Violet or Fiver with these weird, creepy visions. You know that it's just natural in a young boy that he's going to find Bigwig, who's this hard man and loyal to his friends, or the General. Like, the General's just awesome because he's badass and he's got an empire. That's who a young boy is naturally going to choose over all of these other ones.
And yeah, the best evidence for that is how the new Star Wars series, they're failing to sell the merchandise like they used to with the old one. Every kid wants a Darth Vader toy. They don't want a Rey toy or something like that.
Nobody wants a Rey action figure. Like. But, you know, it would be good. I suppose it would have to be a teddy bear for Watership Down, wouldn't it? But that, I'm not going to go down that route. right, so what have you got in mind for next month's review?
I have a couple in mind, but I haven't finalized it yet. So I'd rather not announce it now. I have a few candidates though.
I have to say I'm happy that I got away with the technology because I'm the worst boomer in the world. But Anyway, I think I'll do more streams. I quite enjoyed this. Once I get going, you have a bit crack on with the chat. It's so thanks for the super chats, everybody. And I think we'll catch you next month, and it'll be on Endeavor stream. I think I might do I might have another stream before that on my channel. I'm going to be moving a lot more over to Odyssey as well in the future. So, imagine the films, once we get onto like a blockchain free speech site, we can hit some more controversial movies, which would be pretty good, I think.
Yeah, we'll get the Zulu stream in for that one.
In a way, this, I nearly forgot to make this joke. In a way, our little community kind of wandering around the internet is like the rabbits from Watership Down. I mean, maybe Telegram and Odyssey are going to be our Watership Downs.
Yeah, the BitChute burrow is being industrialized. The plows are coming over.
The BitChute burrow is being filled in as we speak. You've got to get out and head over to the green pastures to Odyssey. Right, that's what we're doing. We're looking for a new home where we can just like have our say in peace. But onwards we go, folks. So thanks for tuning in, and I'll catch you all later.